The international community's attention shifts away from Afghanistan and the foreign aid continues to shrink, the Afghan people still hope for a means of survival that will pull them back from the edge of crisis. Millions of Afghans are facing emergency levels of food insecurity and malnutrition. The UN agencies warn that the situation is expected to worsen rapidly if urgent action are not taken by the global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Dozens of organizations marched in Paris against Islamophobia and racism as Israel's attempted genocide and ethnic cleansing has caused increased state-sponsored repression against Europe's largest Muslim community. A main theme of the march was protecting children. Since October 7th, children as young as 10 years old have been charged with so-called apology for terrorism, while a child of 8 was falsely targeted for praying during recess. Scandals like those have many saying that non-white children are no longer being treated like children, but instead like suspected fanatics, delinquents, and full-grown adults.
We Muslims are enduring so much Islamophobia these days, and it's not like there wasn't a lot of Islamophobia in France already. The targeting of our children is a step too far, and it's incredible that they've taken this shameful step.
As France is accused of targeting Muslim children at home, their elite are giving military and political cover to Israel's mass murder in Gaza of an estimated 15,000 children and the orphaning of some 20,000 others.
On les bombarde.
It's totally unjust how we are watching murder, torture, and the bombing of embassies, and nobody is allowed to say anything. We're here to say, stop the violence against Palestinian and Iranian people.
A decade ago, during another Israeli invasion of Gaza, France became the first country to ever ban pro-Palestinian demonstrations. They banned pro-Palestinian demonstrations for a month after the counterattack by Hamas on October 7th, handing out hundreds of thousands of euros in fines and making mass arrests. Police initially banned this march, claiming it was a threat to public order and possibly anti-Semitic. That was overturned at the last moment, but many say the effort is proof of a long-running double standard against non-whites and non-Jews.
C'est des antisémites. Ça, c'est n'importe quoi.
Anytime there is a march about Palestine or Islamophobia, the interior minister in whatever administration seeks to ban it. The idea that we are anti-Semitic is total nonsense. I get the feeling that I'm more French than many others who aren't of Algerian descent as I am, because many have totally abandoned the longtime values of French political culture.
Similar to during France's two-year state of emergency starting in November 2015, many have been shocked by the lack of outcry at this latest targeting of the Muslim community, despite perpetual bragging of being the alleged birthplace of human rights. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
After almost 3 days, the Israeli forces withdrew from the refugee camp of Nur Shams near the city of Tul Karim in northern occupied West Bank. Only then paramedics were able to evacuate the martyrs' bodies and the families were able to count their dead. Over a dozen Palestinians have been killed since Thursday, but the number might be higher, as reports suggest that Israeli forces had confiscated the bodies of more martyrs. On Sunday, a comprehensive general strike was declared across the occupied West Bank to mourn Tul Karim martyrs. Scores of Palestinians also held a protest in the center of Ramallah against Israel's escalation and violence in Tul Karim and Nur Shams refugee camp.
Israel is expanding its genocide into the West Bank as well. And as we said before, there is no safe place for any Palestinian. And there has to be immediate Palestinian unity to stand up to this terrible aggression. And there has to be international boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign worldwide. And there has to be condemnation.
It's obvious that the Palestinian people, leadership and factions have to declare an immediate comprehensive popular uprising all over the Palestinian territories until the Israeli occupation ends. The ongoing war of attrition is no longer useful, but what's necessary is a national popular uprising.
The Israeli invasion has caused some of the worst destruction in the West Bank in decades. The occupation forces destroyed infrastructure, including sewage lines, shops, homes, and vehicles. Homes were turned into interrogation centers, and dozens of Palestinians were arrested. According to locals, heavy exchange of fire and clashes took place between resistance fighters and Israeli soldiers during the operation. The Israeli military admitted that at least 9 of its soldiers were wounded.
The Israeli occupation regime is escalating its violence against the Palestinian people. Its crimes are meant to exterminate the Palestinian people. In Gaza, genocide is being committed, and here in the West Bank, there are daily incursions, murders, collective punishment, and destruction everywhere. The Israeli occupation is doing its utmost to either bring Palestinians to their knees or commit more aggression and crimes against them.
Sunday's general strike paralyzed all aspects of life in the West Bank, with shops, schools, universities, and banks shuttered. But Palestinians question whether such a standstill is enough, expressing fear that once the Israeli military is done with Gaza, the occupied West Bank could be next. The Israeli military's violence against Palestinians is aimed at countering resistance, people here say. This is part of the Israeli crackdown on armed groups in the occupied West Bank. However, Palestinians say the Israeli crimes, including in the Nur Shams refugee camp, have failed to weaken their determination. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
A two-day international forum dubbed What Future for Palestine kicked off in Rome on Saturday. The initiative, organized by an opposition group called Front of Dissent, has been put together to tackle different topics, namely Zionism, its impact on Palestine and West Asia, the nature of Israel, what changes for the Palestinian resistance after October 7, West Asia in its transition to a multipolar world, and the risk of the Ukraine war escalating into a global conflict. The conference was attended by citizens who are very concerned about the turn the situation has taken in Western countries.
Today's forum is an important attempt to break down the wall of silence surrounding Zionist wrongdoings in West Asia. It is appalling how our mainstream media are covering Israel's brutal war in Gaza. They have created a parallel world and a parallel truth with the aim of covering up the bad things Israel is doing.
The superpowers that support Zionism are former colonial powers, most of them. And they had a role in creating Zionism in the first place. Many people allowed the Zionists to really empower themselves. So they were originally empowered by people who probably had a sense of guilt about the Holocaust, but eventually they became so powerful that they are able to control so many media outlets. They are able to control many politicians.
Speakers at the conference included former diplomats, politicians, journalists, and activists from several countries, including China, the US, Britain, Russia, and many others. Video links were also established with the spokesman for the worldwide anti-Zionist religious group, Neturei Karta International. Analysts at the conference are saying that the aftershocks of the Gaza crisis triggered by Israeli genocidal war are highly likely to reach far beyond West Asia and the Africa region. With the US credibility as a regional security guarantor shot to pieces, West Asia might see increased diplomatic engagement from China and Russia.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan received the head of the Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, in Istanbul. During the meeting that lasted for more than 2.5 hours, the two sides discussed the Israeli aggression on Gaza, ways and measures to ensure uninterrupted and sufficient delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza, and a lasting peace in the West Asia region. During the meeting, President Erdogan stated that amid ongoing tensions in the region, it is important to keep the world's attention on Gaza and not allow the Israeli regime to achieve political gains from its standoff with Iran. In a statement published by the Turkish presidency, Erdogan said, "It is vital that Palestinians act with unity in this process. The strongest response to Israel and the path to victory lie in unity and integrity."
Today's meeting was very important for both Turkey and Hamas to set ground for the upcoming changes. We all know now Qatar is hosting Hamas Bureau and leaders as well as playing the role of mediator in negotiations with Israel. While there is a pressure from Washington for Hamas to leave Qatar, and there is the question of where will Hamas go now, we know that the relation of Hamas and Syria is getting better, and it already has a good relation with Iran. But I don't think they are a choice, and for that, Turkey will be the best option.
Analysts say Turkey will not only be hosting Hamas movement leaders and bureau, but will also take the lead in mediating to reach a lasting solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
Turkey is trying to play a very important role that is bigger than working on reaching a ceasefire in Gaza. It is rather solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and trying to reach a lasting solution. The 7th of October was a turning point to start working on reaching a lasting solution, and I think Turkey's role is a key for it to maintain good relations with all sides.
Hamas had an office in Turkey since 2011, and Turkey mediated in exchange of prisoners. Turkish president maintains warm relations with Haniyeh and says he will always defend the Palestinian cause. Today's meeting takes place against the backdrop of Qatar potentially stepping back from ceasefire talks. This development could create a vacancy that Ankara is well positioned to fill, given Turkey's established relations, particularly with the Hamas movement, which many view as a strategic advantage. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Calls are growing from around the world for an independent and transparent investigation into mass graves recently found in the Gaza Strip. Nearly 400 bodies have so far been recovered from mass graves at two hospitals which were raided by Israeli forces in Gaza. Palestinian officials say there's evidence of field executions and even people being buried alive. Is there any war crime that the Israeli regime has not committed in over 200 days of its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip? And what red lines remain for Tel Aviv to cross so that Western countries led by the United States move to stop this occupying regime? Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have author, journalist, and producer Sakina Dautu, joining us from the British capital, London. And also we have political analyst Mr. Shabir Rizvi, who's also joining us from the British capital.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program to both of our guests. Let's start off with Ms. Dautu in London. It's 203 days of relentless death and destruction. Is it clear now that the Israeli onslaught and massacre is not just against the resistance, but against all of the people in Gaza?
I think there never was doubt at any stage that this was not just against the resistance, but that it was against the people of Palestine. From day one, when we have watched deaths of not just men and women, but children. I mean, we have not seen in history how many children being killed in one go like this indiscriminately. So I think it has been very, very clear from day one, the kind of warfare that has happened, the kind of atrocities we have witnessed, you know, the blanket bombing of people anywhere, the targeting in particular of children, these were all very clear signs, I think, from right from the start, that this was not looking for Hamas, this was not looking for any kind of resistance. This was a war on the Palestinian people. And I think that has continued to become more and more open, such that even those people who probably at one point doubted or were rather confused by the Western media, who has a lot of propaganda going around, and maybe were believing that they were actually out there looking for terrorists, in their words, you know, as freedom fighters. But it is now clear to anyone. I think there isn't probably a soul around the world watching the genocide going on who now believes that what Israel is doing is actually targeting all Palestinians.
Mr. Razvi, as Israel pushes ahead with its genocidal war in Gaza, Hamas has called for an international probe into the mass graves that were found under two of the hospitals that were raided by Israeli occupation forces. The Palestinian defense officials reported evidence of field executions and that a number of the bodies had their hands tied, while some others still had medical tubes attached to them, indicating that they may have been buried alive. 400 bodies have been recovered, some of them even children. There's no way to get around this gut-wrenching and horrifying war crime that the Israelis have committed.
Hello, assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much for your invitation. Look, as I always open these programs with our condolences to over 35,000 martyrs in Palestine and many more in the West Bank, plus also our real supplications for the families whose injured and maimed individuals. So really, we have all the sympathy and support for them. Look, at the end of the day, your word heart-wrenching is really perhaps not sufficient to describe the remorse, the anger that people are sort of expressing. It's palpable on the streets of London, Washington, Los Angeles, all over the planet, that people are clearly seeing that this particular entity, the Zionist entity, the brutal, barbaric entity, has really gone over all sort of accepted moral parameters that one would have had. At the end of the day, Israel is able to commit this genocide because it is being very clearly supported by Washington and the European Union, except a few European nations who are really making noises against the Zionist regime. But the facts on the ground are that, as Bernie Saunders today or yesterday, in response to Netanyahu's interference in American politics, when Netanyahu put forward a video clip saying that American authorities should take strong steps against the protesters in USA, and Bernie Saunders' reply said it is not anti-Semitic to hold Israel to account. And he also further said that the arms being supplied to the Zionist regime is against the American law and its constitution. So we have to really wait and see how many more voices from the political establishment will start jumping ship when they see that the ship is sinking. And also the pressure that's being mounted by the young people in the USA. What I call this is probably the Vietnam moment. as it happened in the 60s when America was engaged in a brutal war in Vietnam. And it was really the students who came out on the streets and at campuses which allowed the Washington and its allies to change their mind. And particularly the U.S. administration had to sue for peace in Paris at that time. And I think hopefully we would move in that direction quite rapidly. But insofar as investigation, your question sort of alluded to was that I don't think there would be any credible investigation which will allow independent investigators to really ascertain sure. that this was a crime that was committed heinously by the Zionist regime. This is one which has come out open, but very clearly, as you all know, there have been many crimes that have been committed in the last nearly 7 months.
Ms. Datu, do you agree with Mr. Rezvi? Do you see this issue of an independent probe transpiring? Will it happen? Will the Israelis allow independent experts to access the site of the mass graves? And will the findings ultimately lead to any consequences for the Israelis?
There is not a chance in the world that Israel will allow any kind of investigation. I mean, this entity, this Zionist entity that is refusing to allow aid, life-saving medicines for Palestinians, there is no chance that they have any kind of intention to allow anyone to probe anything at all. The double standards of the world are very clear here. Here in the UK Parliament, this question was asked that when there was something similar found in Ukraine, the parliament discussed this. And, you know, why was there no mention of the mass graves in Israel that have been found in Palestine? And, you know, the question was forked off completely. So the double standards of the, you know, those who are complicit in the genocide are very clear. At the same time, I think we have to remember that we have seen in the past 6 months complete failure of international bodies being able to take any kind of decision that has any teeth at all. So the United Nations, we saw ICJ, yes, there were bits and pieces here and there, but they have not been able to really come up with any solution which tells us that, you know, these bodies are defunct in reality. And going forward, the only way things are going to change is when now people, like the way we see students, you know, protesting in the US, we have to see this kind of movement globally. We have to see this kind of people movement in the Arab world to start with. And so even though we know their governments are also complicit, because silence is being complicit in a genocide, however, people have got to rise now. They've got to gather the courage to say enough is enough. Nobody is there to speak for us. Nobody is there to, there is nobody internationally that we can count on. So I think I don't have much trust in any of the international bodies or any of the Western countries conducting any kind of a probe that would bring out the reality.
Okay, Ms. Datu, I'm going to stay with you for the next question. Students and faculty members at universities across the USA continue to hold rallies in solidarity with Palestinians. This is something, of course, unprecedented with regards to Palestinian support inside the U.S., from California to Texas to Massachusetts, and also similar demonstrations are spreading in other countries as well, even Jewish communities. They've also been participating in the rallies to support the Palestinian cause and to end this genocidal massacre. Talk to us about that and about the police clampdown on campuses, which is being seen as an attack on freedom of expression.
In terms of, you know, being unprecedented, yes. In relation to Palestine, this is unprecedented. But also, I think we need to remember that any kind of revolution or a major change around the world has started with students. This is the body, once the protests take over, you know, people at university levels, this is when you know that the society is really changing. Young people have got the vigor, the passion to make a change. They are the next generation. Therefore, if their views are changing, then that's a big thing. I think the brutality that we see of the police is nothing surprising. We have to understand that this now, at the moment, has become in most countries a fight between the ruling class and their own people. So whether we are talking of the Western countries, we are talking of Middle Eastern countries, there is a group of those who rule upon us, and it is in their interest, of course, for monetary reasons, for power, they want to keep the status quo as it is. However, the people have been watching all this massacre. I mean, heart-wrenching, you mentioned earlier. I don't think there is any genuine human being who doesn't feel continuous pain watching what is going on. We've been witnessing now, in Rafah, the bombing that has been taking place at the moment. So there is a divide, I think. And because it is a divide, things are going to get a lot more nastier, in my view, before they get better. Because when somebody is losing control, they will be like a wounded animal. They will be hitting left, right, and center. And now we can see that these police and the ruling classes are causing violence upon their own people, because they cannot accept that people have woken up and are seeing the truth. I think that in the shorter term, we will see a lot more violence, a lot more difficult times. But this is really the beginning of the end of Zionism globally.
Mr. Razvi, you alluded to the demonstrations earlier. The students in America, they want universities to divest finances from manufacturers that sell weapons to Israel. They also want Washington to end its military and financial support for the Zionist regime. Those demands have been met with violent crackdowns by U.S. police, and the protesters have been called everything from anti-Semites to terrorists. Again, more double standards when it comes to criticizing Israel.
Well, it's not just double standards. I think it's the moral compass which has been completely lost on the American and European ruling elite, that they really have no fiber of morality left in them. And that's the reason why they're acting the way they are, supporting, doing everything in their power to really rescue the Zionist entity. So what they are doing is, as the sister very clearly pointed out, that things will probably get worse before they get better. And again, I want to put in some historical context. Back in the 60s, when there were demonstrations going on against the war in Vietnam, there was a sort of shooting of students at Kent State University in the USA when the students were demonstrating. So far, we haven't had any deaths of students by troops and security forces in the USA. But the potential is there. It has happened over 60 years ago in the USA itself. So they may bring out firepower and shoot down a few students. One doesn't know how the completely immoral regimes in Washington, London, and Paris are really thinking, that they really want to silence any opposition to their support, their unmitigated, undiluted support for the Zionist regime. And people have indeed awakened, not only awakened, but they're actually trying to hold their rulers and their elites to account. And that's where I think the elite are getting frightened, and they will sort of continue to do whatever they can to really suppress the demonstrations, and at the same time continue to give financial and military support to the Zionist entity. As you know, only a few days ago, $95 billion were written to support Israel, Ukraine, and other entities to fight against what they call terrorists or state. So what we are seeing is that the ordinary people in America's taxpayers' money is being given to the Zionist entity. And whilst we know very well the education system in USA is creaking, the healthcare does not exist for a prosperous nation like USA. People are sleeping in the streets from New York to Seattle to Los Angeles, all over the place. And, you know, 50 million people in the USA have no health care, while the US taxpayer money goes to Tel Aviv, and there the settlers get
absolutely
free houses, free health care, free education, and money to live comfortably. So people are realizing that their tax dollars are being wasted on a Zionist entity. So that's another angle that people are really looking at, not just sort of divestment and sort of stopping armament trade, armament support for the Zionist entity.
Ms. Sekine Datu, I want to bring the same issue to you as well. The rallies, they gain more steam to protest the recent approval of more military aid for the Israeli regime. About that aid package, billions of taxpayer dollars will continue to go to Israel to continue its genocide. What was your reaction to the approval of that bill?
I think, you know, in addition to what Brother Shabir was just saying, 40 million people, this is 12% of the population of the U.S., is on food stamps. This is the basic need of food, you know, and then we've seen 14.1 billion, you know, committed to Israel and only to go for military equipment. It just beggars belief, to be honest. I think if I was an American, I would not be able to understand this. And this is exactly what is happening with people awakening. I mean, how does it make any sense to anyone that you are subjugating your own people who, and by the way, it isn't just in the US. This is happening in the UK too. I mean, being the seventh largest economy here in the UK, the economic situation of the people isn't great. We see homelessness, we see food banks rising every day, and yet our leaders every time are spending money and sending them to Israel. So I think people really are finding that this very, very uncomfortable. I mean, I have had people come up to me. So, you know, when I travel on the underground, for example, I wear my Palestinian badge everywhere. And I have had literally people stop me, people who I would not expect to be at all pro-Palestinian, and tell me, thank you. Thank you for wearing this. And we are feeling the pain. Sometimes we are not able to express it. These are people who will say to me, we are Sikh, we are Christians, we don't believe in any religion, you know, Jewish, but we are really hurting. So I think this is one aspect, but the other aspect is people are really angry. They're very angry, and coming elections in both countries, in the US and UK, I think will reveal very clearly how unhappy people are, that their hard-earned tax money is so easily being sent to Israel, and that too, to kill children. I don't think anyone now can stand this.
Mr. Rivkin, let's backtrack a few weeks now. How do you view the massive global support that Iran received for carrying out Operation True Promise against the Israelis on April the 13th? The support that Iran received for shattering Israel's myth of invincibility. Now, minus the U.S. and other accomplices of the Israelis, almost all regional countries, they expressed support for what Iran carried out.
Firstly, the Israel's military invincibility was obviously shattered on 7th of October when Hamas mounted a terrific military operation. Not myself, but other military experts have very clearly sort of expressed and articulated that may be taught at military schools how to defend your land. But of course, what Iran did is an extraordinary event in the historical context. What has happened is that for the last, since the advent of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, Iran has obviously experienced all kinds of problems that has been inflicted on the nation. They've had sort of multiple sanctions from them, 8-year war, scientists have been assassinated, and of course the ultimate was really the assassination and murder of its officials at an embassy in a third country. A sovereign entity, a sovereign land was invaded in a sovereign country. So that really left no option for Iran to do what they did to respond. But they gave ample warning, nearly 2 weeks of it. And what did show that Iran is not going to keep quiet. And as the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Rahbar, has quite clearly said that the days of hit and run are over. And I think the U.S. And its allies who supported Israel when Iran had defended itself by launching a missile and drone attack on Israel shows clearly that Israel is not able to defend itself on its own. It needs USA, France, and UK to do so, plus also Jordan participating in that particular enterprise. So what it shows clearly is that in future, what will happen is that Iran has clearly shown the world that it will not only defend itself, but also, you may recall, at that particular night for 24 hours, there were no bombing that took place in Gaza. There was a respite for a few hours for the people of Gaza when these drones were being stopped in halfway reaching Israel. So the resistance movement, the people, the oppressed people of the world, and anyone who is standing for their own right now feel rather proud, happy, and as I've said somewhere else, that the oracle of the oppressed, which is what the Islamic Republic of Iran has spoken.
And a final thought from Ms. Datu: Israel has been a menace to all countries around it, like Lebanon and Syria, where Israel constantly violates their sovereignty and carries out illegal strikes on a regular basis. As Mr. Rezvi alluded to earlier, Iran has said the era of Israeli hit and run is over. Has Iran now set a precedent where Israeli attacks and destabilizing actions will be dealt with appropriately?
Iran has definitely set a precedence. And, you know, when we look at the history of Iran, there's been so much propaganda against the Islamic Republic for so long. And I think for me and for a lot of Muslims out there, the way we see it is the religious values and morals that, you know, within the Iranian thinking that has brought it to this stage. And we have examples, I think, which Iran follows. And for me, what I see here is I see the example, for example, of the son-in-law and the cousin of the Holy Prophet, Ali ibn Abu Talib, that when he finally would go into the battlefield and raise his Zulfikar, the enemy would struggle and would be shivering. These are the principles. Ali is the principle on which Iran is running. And therefore, they have now come down into the battlefield and the enemies are shaking.
Okay.
But inshallah, we will see the victory.
All right. Thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thanks to author, journalist, and producer Sakina Datu joining us from London. Also joining us from the British capital, political analyst Mr. Shebi Rezvi. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
State law takes the United States a step closer to popular vote deciding presidential elections. Maine is the latest state to pass the National Popular Vote Legislation law. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. After much public debate, a Maine law has brought the country closer to having the popular vote determine the winner of national presidential elections, but it's unlikely that will happen before next November or even at all. Earlier this week, Maine's governor, Janet Mills, allowed a bill to become law without her signature that would take effect once the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is able to gather pledges for at least 270 electoral votes, the number of delegate votes needed to elect a president. The movement has now gathered pledges from 17 states and Washington, D.C., accounting for a total of 209 electoral votes. The movement seeks to change the way a president is chosen without a constitutional amendment, but experts say it's unclear what happens when enough states have signed on. It's unlikely this would happen before next November's 2024 election. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact seeks to guarantee that the candidate who receives the most popular votes in all 50 states and the District of Columbia wins the presidency. When there are enough states pledging their popular votes to meet the 270 Electoral College vote threshold, all the votes in those states will be added up to a national count that determines the winner of the election. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact says that will give each vote equal weight regardless of where a voter lives. 5 of the 46 presidents who came into office lost the popular vote, including Donald Trump, most recently in 2016. The compact argues that not every vote is equal under the current system. Under the current system, a small number of votes in a small number of states regularly decides the presidency. All or nothing payoffs fuel doubt, controversy over real or imagined irregularities, hair-splitting post-election litigation, and unrest, the compact says on its website. In 2020, if 21,461 voters had changed their minds, Joe Biden would have been defeated, despite leading by over 7 million votes nationally. Each of these 21,461 voters, 5,229 in Arizona, 5,890 in Georgia, and 10,342 in Wisconsin, was 329 times more important than the 7 million voters elsewhere, the compact says. One expert says that everything that has to do with the Electoral College is controversial these days, with a partisan divide on the issue. Many Democrats want to get rid of the Electoral College, while more Republicans support it. If you look at all the presidential elections from 1992 through to 2020, Republicans have won the presidential popular vote only once, and that was in 2004 when George W. Bush beat John Kerry in the popular vote. In every other election over the last 30 years, Democrats have won the popular vote, but because of the Electoral College, Republicans have gotten the presidency a couple of times despite losing the popular vote. Darrell West, a Douglas Dillon chair in government studies at the Brookings Institute, told ABC News in an interview, "Republicans feel the Electoral College advantages them now, and so they don't want to get rid of it." Darrell West added, "The country currently only has a handful of swing states because of the Electoral College system, so candidates spend most of their money on that small number of states. If we got rid of the Electoral College system, candidates actually would campaign more broadly. They would visit more states because a vote in Illinois is the same as a vote in California," West said. Experts say the most direct way to change how presidents are elected is to amend the U.S. Constitution, but there doesn't currently seem to be a feasible pathway without a consensus between the two political parties. Darrell West added, "Ultimately, there probably is going to have to be a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College, but everyone knows that's not possible now for political reasons. it takes a very large majority in Congress, as well as in the states, to make any change to the Constitution. So what states are trying to figure out is, short of a constitutional amendment, are there ways to improve the Electoral College? The website truthout.org has also covered the same story and tells us more. Maine has become the 18th jurisdiction in the United States to pass the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which, if enacted, would end the Electoral College's influence in the selection process for the office of President of the United States. The bill, which has passed by the Democratic-controlled state legislature, made it to Governor Janet Mills' desk last week. Governor Janet Mills opted not to sign the bill, but also chose not to veto it, allowing it to pass into law. Governor Mills said she understood both sides of the argument when it came to the compact, simultaneously claiming that such a measure would diminish Maine's influence in presidential elections, a talking point against ending the Electoral College that has been widely debunked, while also agreeing that the possibility of a future presidential election being decided that disregards voters' preferences would be unfair. Absent a ranked choice voting circumstance, it seems to me that the person who wins the most votes should become the president, Governor Mills said in a statement justifying her decision. Such elections have happened twice in the 21st century alone. In 2000, despite Democrat Al Gore winning more votes, Republican George W. Bush won the presidency. And again in 2016, Republican Donald Trump defeated Democrat Hillary Clinton despite losing the popular vote by millions of ballots. Overall, the Electoral College has failed five times in U.S. history to select the presidential candidate whom most American voters preferred. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact isn't enforced yet, as it can only be enacted after enough states sign on, equaling a majority of the Electoral College 270 votes. With Maine's inclusion in the compact, 17 states plus Washington, D.C. have signed on, amounting to 209 Electoral College votes. Ordinarily, any change to how the president is selected would require passing an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, a process that could take many years and would likely fail in the current political climate. However, the compact sidesteps this problem by using provisions in the Constitution to enact a popular vote. Article 2 of the Constitution states that, for the purposes of selecting a president, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in Congress. If the states themselves decide to assign electors based on who wins the national popular vote, the process is wholly legal. Polling shows that most Americans want a popular voting system to replace the Electoral College. A Pew Research survey from last autumn, for example, found that 65% of Americans want to change the current system of selecting the president so that the person receiving the most votes from voters wins, versus just 33% who said they wanted to keep the current system intact. After Maine passed the compact into law, National Popular Vote Chair John Kozer released a statement applauding the state's action. Maine joining the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact moves us one step closer to a system where the presidential candidate who wins the most popular votes always wins the presidency, and every voter in every state is politically relevant in every presidential election, John Kozer said in a press release. More than 6 in 10 Americans say that the Electoral College should be abolished and replaced with a popular vote model for selecting the president and vice president, a new opinion poll has shown. In a Pew Research Center survey that was published recently, 63% of the American people backed instituting a popular vote model over the current electoral college system. The highest rate the organization has seen in support of instituting a popular vote system since at least the year 2000. Only 35% of the poll's respondents preferred keeping the current electoral college in place.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.